Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 65, When the Sun Was Not. Today, we finally begin our narrative of the Arian controversy. Our story begins in Alexandria with its bishop, Alexander, whose theology we examined last episode. When Alexander became bishop in 313, his position was oddly ambiguous. Outside of Alexandria, he was the Coptic Pope, the leader of the churches of all of Egypt and Libya. Yet within the city itself, he resembled more of a first among equals than a monarchical bishop. Alexandrian Christianity had long been fractious, as we've seen in prior episodes. This was even manifested in the church buildings, which were spread out and varied, reflecting the historically haphazard nature of Christianity's growth in the city. Alexandria had a long history of competing Greek schools as well, and this appears to have been reflected in the Christian communities. From the different Gnostic sects in the 2nd century to the catechetical school of Origen in the 3rd. You may remember that part of the reason for the tension, and eventual fallout, between Bishop Demetrius and Origen was the latter's independent school. The great scholar initially led his school on his own authority, apart from the bishop. Demetrius wanted Origen to work as a catechist under episcopal supervision. Like Origen, the presbytery in Alexander's day still continued to operate in a similar fashion as quasi-independent leaders of their own communities. The presbyters had maintained this independence in spite of the attempts of successive bishops to consolidate their authority. Within the walls of their churches, presbyters were in some ways beyond the control of the Bishop of Alexandria. Tensions between bishop and presbyter could lead to schism. Among the more independent-minded presbyters in the early 4th century was a man named Caluthus, who gathered to himself a loyal following. His rupture with Alexander did eventually result in full-blown schism. Alexander also had other schismatics right on his doorstep. First and foremost were the Miletians, who, despite the martyrdom of Peter of Alexandria, had continued to propagate their rival church. Another schismatic group were the followers of Hierakas of Leontopolis in the Nile Delta, an extreme ascetical group whose leader disputed the physicality of the resurrection, rejected marriage, and made extensive use of questionable non-canonical texts. All of this is to say that the position of Bishop Alexander in these early years was quite precarious. So it was, perhaps in an effort to establish his authority, that Alexander began to publicly pronounce on the relationship between the Father and the Son, and invited the presbyters to give their opinions on the matter. Alexander taught that God has always been Father, and the Son has always been his Son. The Son is eternally generated from the Father. The two are co-eternal. Among the presbyters of the city who heard this, there was one who took great issue with the bishop's theology. This man was the prominent and popular presbyter of the important church of the Bacchalis district, a gifted preacher named Arius. So who was this Arius? Our knowledge of his life and career prior to the start of the great controversy which bears his name is sketchy at best. We know Arius originated from Roman Libya, but his year of birth is unknown. Given he was already an elderly man by the time the controversy began, he was probably born in the third quarter of the 3rd century. Of his considerable education, we know almost nothing, save for a tantalizing detail in one of his letters, where he describes himself as a fellow or co-Lucianist. This statement has traditionally been understood to mean that Arius had been a student of the famous presbyter, biblical scholar, and martyr Lucian of Antioch, whom we discussed last episode. We'll return to the connection between Arius and the disciples of Lucian a little later, But it should be noted that some scholars are more cautious on this point. They argue that to claim on the basis of this one statement that Arius was a full-fledged disciple of Lucian is an overreading of the evidence. So while it's possible Arius was a follower of Lucian, his connection to the martyred Antiochian could have been much more minimal. With little information available on his education, we now turn to the matter of Arius's ecclesiastical career. He seems to have been ordained a presbyter by either Peter or Peter's successor Achilles. One thing we need to address, though, about Arius's earlier career is his possible connection to the Meletian schism. Back during our coverage of the Great Persecution, we discussed how Meletius eventually made his way to Alexandria, where he gained allies against the exiled Pope Peter in two local presbyters. One of those presbyters was named Arius. As such, many have asserted in the past that this Meletian Arius and our Arius are one and the same. However, few scholars accept this identification today, primarily because none of our contemporary sources support it. It is only in the 5th century that the identification first appears. We have numerous writings from those who opposed Arius during his lifetime, including writers from Alexandria. Had Arius previously been an ally of Meletius, these authors surely would have wasted no time pointing this out. Alas, then, we must concede we know relatively little about Arius prior to his entrance on the stage of history in Alexandria. However, at some point, Arius was given charge of the church of the Bacchalis district, either by Achilles or Alexander. Exactly where the Bacchalis district was is not certain, but many scholars think it was located in the eastern part of the city, by the harbor. Arius was one of the leading presbyters of the city, popular with his congregation and well regarded for his preaching on the scriptures. He dressed like an ascetical philosopher, wearing a short cloak and sleeveless tunic. As an official catechist, Arius was responsible for bringing new converts into the church. Whatever else we might try to say about his background, Arius enters history as a card-carrying member of the Catholic Church in Alexandria. So what exactly did Arius believe that made him react so strongly against Alexander's theology? This question is, of course, laden with the same problem we've encountered for all the previous heretics we've dealt with on this podcast. Most of what we know about Arius is based on the writings of his theological opponents. We possess very little of what Arius himself actually wrote. We therefore have to pick through the various summaries, paraphrases, quotations, and distortions of his enemies. As I mentioned last week, Arius belonged to the theological trend which put primary emphasis on the differences within the Trinity. From what we can reconstruct, it seems safe to conclude that Arius taught the following. God the Father alone is the eternal, unoriginate, ungenerate, singular source of all things. There could only be one monad, one first principle. In eternity past, before creation and time and the ages, the Father created the Son by his will out of nothing. The Son is thus a creature whose hypostasis is by definition distinct and different from the hypostasis of the Father. Unbegottenness, eternality, and immutability are proper to the Father alone. The Son, by contrast, is generated and created, a creature, and therefore theoretically changeable and mutable. The very language of Father and Son implied a hierarchy, subordination, and a sequence of the two. The scriptures testified to this for Arius. For example, in Proverbs 8, Wisdom, who Arius, like all others, identified as the Son, declared that the Lord created me as the beginnings of his works. You may be asking, though, if Arius believed the Son is wisdom, how could he believe the Father's wisdom had been created? Arius also believed the Son was the Logos, or Word, as did all other Christians. But again, if the Son is the Word of the Father, how could he not be co-eternal? Surely the Father was not dumb and mute in eternity past. This was, as we discussed last episode, one of Alexander's reasonings for the doctrine of eternal generation. Arius argued that the Son is called Word and Wisdom because he participates in the Father's self-contained Word and Wisdom, not because those names refer to what the Son is in and of himself. The Father is eternally perfect and self-subsistent. The Son, therefore, does not know the Father inherently. Instead, the Son only knows the Father as much as the Father chooses to reveal himself to the Son. In advancing his theology, Arius shared a number of concerns with many other Christians of his day. First and foremost was the specter of Sabellianism. Arius was, after all, from Libya, which had seen a strong Sabellian presence since the days of Dionysius of Alexandria. This was partly why Arius insisted in such a sharp distinction between the Father and Son, and even the Holy Spirit. Arius believed there exists a trinity of three unequal glories and three distinct and different hypostases. To make the members of the Godhead equally divine and co-eternal risked, in Arius's mind, erasing the fundamental distinctions between them and destroying the Godhead. Both the Father and Son could be called God, but the Father was true God, true eternal divinity. Hence why Arius argued only the Father is immutable, while the Son is mutable. Immutability was a characteristic of true divinity, like eternality. This meant that, by nature, the Son was not inherently sinless. Arius, of course, believed the Son had never sinned, but sinlessness was not automatic to his nature. Related to his concern over Sabellianism was Arius's concern with the associated heresy of patripassionism, that the Father suffered on the cross. This is why, for Arius, the creation of the Son could not represent any material division in God. Arius ardently rejected materialistic language which suggested a piece of the Father had been broken off to create the Son. The Son was not an emanation or extension of the Father, but the unique Son created out of nothing. No piece of the Father was nailed to the cross at Calvary. Behind these concerns also lie Arius's opposition to the great heresies of the past, Valentinian Gnosticism and Manichaeism, and even the recent schismatic Hierarchus we mentioned earlier, heresies which the Church of Alexandria was actively contending with. At its most extreme, therefore, Arian theology espoused that in eternity past there was a time when the Son was not. The Father was alone, was not Father, and then he created the Son out of nothing and became Father. Arius himself may not have originally articulated his theology in such stark terms, but as he came into conflict with Alexander, the phrase, "there was a time when the Son was not," became a sort of slogan for Arian theology. There was much in Arius's theology Alexander could agree with. Both men believed God the Father is in some sense greater than the Son, as the Lord stated in the Gospel of John, chapter 14. Both believed the Father alone is the unbegotten, unoriginate, ungenerate first principle and beginning of all things. Both believed the Son is distinct from the Father, generate, and begotten. However, Alexander did not agree with Arius that the Son's generation meant he was created. He rejected Arius's argument that if the Son is co-eternal, that meant he is a second unbegotten first principle, compromising the unique monotheistic status of the Father. Alexander also rejected any notion that there were two words or two wisdoms of God. Word and wisdom are not titles bestowed on the Son. The Son truly is the word and wisdom of the Father. There was never a time when the Father's word and wisdom were not. On perhaps the most controversial points of Arius' theology, Alexander was also dramatically opposed. The Son is immutable, like the Father. He could never fall into sin. He is inherently sinless, just like his Father. In addition, the Son is a proper Son who knows the Father uniquely, intimately, and inherently. This knowledge is not limited to what the Father reveals of himself to the Son. There is no great chasm between God the Father and the Son like there is between God and creation. Alexander rejected Arius' teaching, but the presbyter remained defiant, and other presbyters and deacons came to his support. Attempting to trace the chronology of the early controversy has proven to be a difficult task for modern historians. We have a plethora of different letters and fragments with almost no firm dates to go by. Ross Twelly has done a wonderful job on his blog breaking down the problems with dating our sources and detailing the different chronologies proposed by modern scholars. I've posted a link to this in the show notes for this episode. The chronology I've opted for here is mainly based on the work of Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, in his book, Arius, History and Tradition, a book which has been of tremendous help in writing these episodes. Williams's chronology seems, to me at least, to be the most straightforward and requires the least amount of speculative reconstruction. The exact year the conflict between Alexander and Arius began is not certain. The earliest year I've seen scholars opt for is 318, and the latest possible year is 323. Much of this depends on how much time you think is required in order for all the events to play out, as well as the general character of the early controversy. Was it something that slowly boiled over a few years, or did it ignite in a short span of time? I'm not going to try to pin down the exact year, and will simply say that the controversy began circa 320 AD, give or take a couple years. Alexander convened a synod in the city to formally review and pronounce judgment on Arius and his local followers, whom I will refer to as the Arians. The Arians submitted a formal written confession in which they insisted that the faith they taught was the faith of the Catholic Church. The confession attempted to be diplomatic by referring to Alexander affectionately as Blessed Father, and by de-emphasizing the mutability of the Son. Nevertheless, Alexander and the Synod still condemned and excommunicated the Arians. Arius was not cowed, however. He and his followers had the support of many, both within Alexandria as well as in Arius' homeland of Libya. It was from Libya that Arius gained steadfast and long-lasting support from two bishops, Secundus of Ptolemais and Theonas of Marmarica. Within the city, the Arian presbyters could look to the support of their respective congregations, as well as hundreds of consecrated virgins who followed Arius's cause. Due to this support, Alexander's synod was unable to intimidate Arius into submission. The Arians continued to organize conventicles within the city, and riots appear to have broken out between the two camps, not surprising for the riot-happy citizens of Alexandria. The schismatic Caluthus, who was himself an opponent of Arius, used the conflict as a pretext to further entrench his and his followers' separation from Alexander, probably by having himself consecrated bishop. Alexander and his supporters, for their part, were publicly rebuked by Arius's followers, especially the virgins, and were even accused before the civil authorities. However, Alexander still retained the loyalty of most of the city's Christians, and his side managed to gain the upper hand. Eventually, the situation for the Arians in Alexandria became untenable, and they were driven from the city. Their cause soon found receptive ears among the bishops of Palestine, Phoenicia, and Syria. Arius' chief supporters from these provinces included none other than our church historian Eusebius of Caesarea. The most prominent bishops who joined Eusebius in supporting Arius were his friends, Paulinus of Tyre, the man to whom Eusebius addressed his sermon on the Church of Tyre some years earlier, as well as Theodotus of Laodicea. Theodotus was, according to Eusebius, a man skilled in both medicine and pastoral care. He had succeeded the apostate bishop Stephen, who had succumbed during the Great Persecution. Theodotus had even been a recipient of apologetic works authored by Eusebius. Added to this alliance was another man named Patrophilus, the bishop of Scythopolis in Palestine. Though these aren't all the Levantine bishops who supported Arius in some way, they will be the most prominent in our narrative. The bishops convened a council in Palestine, probably in Caesarea, formally pledging their support for Arius and offering him and his followers refuge in their dioceses, even inviting Arius and his like-minded presbyters to preach in their churches. The council and its members also issued letters in support of Arius and reproached Alexander for his actions. The dispute had thus officially extended beyond the borders of Egypt. The flight of Arius and his followers to Palestine from Alexandria is certainly reminiscent of what happened to Origen nearly a century earlier. The parallels between the two situations could not have been lost on either side. Now, like his predecessor Demetrius, Alexander realized he needed to gather wider support for his cause as well. Alexander composed and then circulated a tome against Arius and his followers. The text details the conflict thus far and provides a lengthy critique of Arius's theology. The encyclical was first presented to the bishops of Egypt, the Thebaid, and Libya. After acquiring these signatures, Alexander sent his letter north to Syria, Asia Minor, and eventually across the Bosporus, with the tome acquiring ever more signatures along the way. Among the most important clerics who sided with Alexander was Philogonius, bishop of Antioch, the capital and chief see of Syria. As a result, the Levant became a contested region between the two sides. Though the chronology is uncertain, it seems plausible that Arius's next move was in response to Alexander's tome. At the prodding of his Syro-Palestinian allies, the exiled presbyter wrote to arguably the next most powerful bishop in the East, after Alexandria and Antioch, the bishop of the eastern imperial capital of Nicomedia, a man named Eusebius. Eusebius of Nicomedia, not to be confused with the church historian from Palestine, is going to be one of the most important political players in our narrative for the next couple decades. In many ways, Eusebius of Nicomedia will eclipse Arius as the driving force behind the events which unfold. Originally, Eusebius had been the bishop of Beirut in Phoenicia, but had translated his see to Nicomedia at some point shortly before the controversy began. He was related to the Emperor Licinius's Praetorian prefect, Julius Julianus, and soon became a prominent member of the imperial court. Eusebius also seems to have been a close confidant of Constantia, Licinius's wife and Constantine's sister. Eusebius's political connections would grow even stronger when Julianus's daughter later married into the Constantinian dynasty. It is in his letter to Eusebius of Nicomedia that Arius refers to himself as a co-Lucianist. Whatever this meant with regards to Arius, we do know Eusebius of Nicomedia was a disciple of Lucian. His theology shared with Arius a desire to preserve the unique status of the Father, and a belief that the Son was generated by an act of the Father's will. Eusebius believed the Son in no way shared in the Father's ungenerate nature. Alongside Eusebius in publicly pledging support for Arius were two other Bithynian bishops who had also been disciples of Lucian, Theognis of Nicaea and Marus of Chalcedon. The Bithynian trio convened a home synod at Nicomedia, which pronounced in favor of Arius and communicated its decisions to the various churches of the eastern provinces. Alongside the conciliar decisions, Eusebius also dispatched the traveling preacher Asterius the Sophist to tour Asia Minor and drum up support for Arius. Originating from Cappadocia, Asterius will prove to be an important theologian in the early days of the controversy. He was not an ordained clergyman, since he had lapsed during the Great Persecution. Despite his enforced lay status, however, Asterius's skills in theology and popular preaching earned him recognition, enough for Eusebius to press his considerable skills into service for the pro-Arian cause. Soon, many more bishops were offering their support to Arius, even writing in defense of him and his theology to Alexander. Not every bishop who offered Arius support went this far, however, or even agreed with his theology. Some bishops merely felt what Arius taught was within the acceptable limits of orthodoxy, and that Alexander had overreacted. In addition to the Bithynian Synod and Asterius's preaching, the Bishop of Nicomedia also aided Arius in another way. In his reply to Arius's letter, Eusebius encouraged the exiled Alexandrian to put his doctrine into verse. This would make Arian theology more approachable to the average lay Christian and increase his support among the rank and file. Arius therefore produced his most significant theological work, titled in Greek as Thalia, meaning the banquet, a work mixing prose and verse. It seems the slogan, "There was when the sun was not," grew in popularity as a result of this text. Naturally, only fragments of the book survive today, mostly as quotations from Arius's opponents. However, what we do have has been vital for modern historians in reconstructing Arius's theology. As the spring of 323 approached, the Eastern churches had split into two competing factions, those supporting Alexander and those supporting Arius. We'll unpack the composition of these factions as the narrative continues. However, I do want to make some general points about these alliances, which will be good for us to remember throughout the upcoming narrative. The theological factions of the Arian controversy were not perfectly cohesive groups. The individual members of these alliances did not all share the same theology, and some even differed from one another in dramatic ways. Historian Sarah Parvis notes that it's best to think of these alliances as akin to modern political parties. I would also compare them to political coalitions containing multiple parties as well. Not everyone in the coalition believes the same thing, with some members on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to certain issues. However, the coalition members have enough in common that they're willing to put aside their differences in the interest of shared concerns, goals, and of course, opponents. This very much describes the character of both the pro-Alexander and pro-Arian alliances in this period, as well as the factions later on in the controversy. While we could survey all the major players on either side at this stage and go through this or that bishop's individual theology, I'm going to spare you that and stick to what's critical for us to understand at this point. We'll have more time to introduce important characters in our story over the next few episodes. I don't want this episode to just devolve into an endless listing of the names of various bishops. I feel I've already dropped a lot of names on you, as it is. I also don't want to overload you with the details of each one of their theological distinctives. Some bishops will be more important to us for their political roles, while others will be more theologically significant. Others just aren't as important in the overall scheme of things. Though Arius had support from bishops scattered throughout the Eastern Empire, the strongest bases of the pro-Arian alliance consisted of bishops from Bithynia, Cilicia, Libya, and the Levant. In contrast, Alexander could count on Egypt, the Thebaid, most of Asia Minor, Thrace, as well as many within Libya and the Levant as well. Though Arius claimed all the East confessed the Father precedes the Son, the reality was Alexander's faction was in the majority. At most, we can only identify a little over 20 bishops by name who supported Arius to some degree or another. There is even evidence to suggest some of Arius's supporters were wavering. A letter of Eusebius of Nicomedia addressed to Paulinus of Tyre survives, where the Bithynian bishop chides his Phoenician colleague for not actively engaging in the controversy and writing more on behalf of Arius. In contrast, Alexander at some point was able to convene a council in Alexandria of nearly 100 Egyptian and Libyan bishops, and he eventually went on to secure possibly another 100 episcopal condemnations of Arius from further abroad, including, possibly, Sylvester of Rome. Perhaps seeing that his side was losing ground, Eusebius of Nicomedia decided to use his political connections to engineer an imperial intervention. Sometime in the summer of 323, at the prodding of Eusebius, the Eastern Emperor issued a decree banning bishops from convening together in church councils. Though the extent to which this was carried out can't be certain, for now at least, Licinius's administration put the kibosh on the burgeoning controversy. Unfortunately, Licinius's decision to ban episcopal assemblies turned out to be the opening salvo in a new persecution. Next episode, we'll catch up with Constantine in the West and trace the fallout between the two Augusti. After their first civil war, Licinius will begin to turn against his Christian subjects before finally decreeing persecution. Constantine will respond by portraying their final conflict as a war of liberation for the Eastern Christians. In the end, the Christian emperor will stand alone as the sole and undisputed master of the entire Roman Empire.